not Operation Wake Up. Cheers. Hello. Hello. This is Resistance Radio. Every Tuesday afternoon at 5:30, bringing to you stories of anti-capitalism, anti-globalization, altermundialistas. Lots of stories today, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Resistance Radio, and the theme song you just heard is sung in Creole, and the word in Creole and Haitian Creole for resistance is résistance. Big surprise. Anyway, the song's in Creole. It's by Soane Auguste, who after the coup in Haiti, 2004, there was an orchestrated Canadian, French, and Australian orchestrated coup d'état against the democratically elected leader of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and militarized state soon unfurled from that situation. Point being, there was thousands of political prisoners, thousands of opposition politicians thrown in jail, and as well as folk singers, musicians, and political activists. One of them was Soanne Auguste, who was the singer of that theme song. So anyway, we're happy to play that song. So Resistance Radio, this is every Tuesday happening on CKDU 88.1 FM, www.ckdu.ca on the internet. Resistance Radio is a show that's brought to you in English, en francés y en español, aussi en français et en espagnol, qui chronique les mouvements, which chronicles movements and groups, communities who actively struggle for land, for their land, their rights to self-determination, for freedom, to dignity, to self, to sovereignty, and to their lands in traditional ways, or for groups who stand in solidarity with those communities and those struggles. And often these struggles are against capitalism, colonialism, imperialism, neoliberalism, economic globalization. All these trends link together, and the way they intersect is something that we focus on and look at here on the radio program that you're listening to right now. My name is David Parker. If you're interested in finding out more about Resistance Radio, give us a call at 494-2487. Today's show, we're looking at capitalism and the economic crisis. The question that we're asking today is the economic crisis of 2008, the worst economic crisis in ever globally. And is capitalism safe from crises, or are they bound to occur under the free market model? Are these crises inevitable? Can we avoid them? Is there some way around them? Or are they an inevitable product of a free market capitalist system where corporations are allowed to run rampant with speculation running rampant? We have an expert on the subject who will speak a lot more eloquently than me on the subject, John Clark of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, based in Toronto, who in this interview with Aaron Lakoff, a community radio journalist based in Montreal, John Clark comments on the recent global economic crisis, its impacts on poor people, and recent elections. In mid-September, the worst ever global economic crisis hit, right in the middle of federal election campaigns in the USA and Canada. Saving our broken economies immediately became the main focus of the election campaigns in both countries. While the media has paid much attention to the unprecedented $700 billion bailout to Wall Street and other large corporations in the whole, little attention has been paid to how this economic crisis is impacting those who are always at the losing end of the economic system, being working class and poor people. Not to mention racialized communities, First Nations communities, black communities in North America, etc. Recently, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, put out a statement on the economic crisis, highlighting courses of action that communities living in poverty can take to fight what might now be an imminent string of deeper privatizations and cuts to the social safety net. Now, with provincial elections approaching in Quebec, or they're on in Quebec right now, political parties are again campaigning heavily around people's fears of the economic crisis in order to buy votes. For example, Stephen Harper was definitely campaigning as the strong leader who will guide us out of this terrible economic crisis. Of course, the way it's portrayed in the media, as this communique states, is definitely, you know, a threat to the middle class and the upper class and savings and investors and like how to protect your investments. But really, what doesn't get discussed is the people who aren't investing, the people who are in debt, the people who are working class, lower class, homeless, jobless, racialized communities. And so that's not being discussed in the mainstream media, and that's what we want to focus on here. Anyway, John Clark from OCAP is an advocate for these groups, for these communities, these classes, these racialized groups. So we're going to be hearing a good interview with him, done by Aaron Lakoff. John Clark is a longtime community organizer with OCAP. He analyzes the impacts of the economic crisis and highlights solutions beyond the ballot boxes, which is pretty interesting. Music in this piece is by $100. And Chumbawamba. And I think without further ado, we're just going to cut to that interview, as long as it plays right now. Yep, here it is. So you're listening to CKDU.
My lumens are saying all day, poverty, poverty knock. Got us too skinny to pay, poverty, poverty knock. Keeping one eye on the clock,
I know I can gutter when I hear my shuttle go. Poverty, poverty knock.
Up every morning at 5.
I'm joined on the line right now with John Clark, who's a community organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in Toronto. Thank you very much for joining us today, John.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We're going to be talking about the economic crisis, about poverty in Ontario, and looking also at how the economic crisis has played out in recent elections in Canada and, of course, in the United States. So to begin, OCAP put out a statement, I guess just about a couple weeks ago, on the economic crisis. And the heading of this statement is, it's their system, they broke it, and we're not going to fix it. Can you explain OCAP's take on the financial crisis and the bailouts for the rich? Can you tell us maybe what you mean by bailouts for the rich?
Well, you do have this now, this vast crisis that's began to play out in the financial markets, is spreading to the so-called real economy, and is having potentially absolutely catastrophic and certainly at least very, very serious consequences. And one of the first things that must strike people, and certainly in terms of the U.S. bailout, there was a sharp reaction from people phoning into the elected representatives and such like, is that in fact the whole notion of the neoliberal agenda has been justified on the basis that there's no alternative, that there's no resources for things like hospitals and schools and social programs and the things people need. And then the system suddenly runs into trouble, and all of a sudden billions and billions and billions of dollars are suddenly available to bail out banks and to bail out capitalism. And there's an obvious, striking, massive injustice and contradiction that people become immediately aware of. I mean, all the time we deal with the welfare system here in Toronto, and we're dealing with the most vicious, penny-pinching attempts to deny people even the few miserable entitlements that they're supposed to get under the system. And politically, this is always justified on the basis of a lack of resources. And you know, the next time we confront someone telling us that there's nothing available for a family that's facing eviction, that can't put food on the table, we're going to ourselves take it much less seriously than we did in the past. Not that we were particularly serious about it before.
Some of the major bailouts that have happened in the U.S., some of our listeners may be familiar with. In Canada recently, one that I can think of that happened was the city of Vancouver bailing out the company that's building the Olympic Village in the downtown east side. Do you know of any other specific instances that have already hit in Canada where large companies have been bailed out due to this economic crisis?
Well, I think the things that have already occurred are the buying up of mortgages, the putting up of money for the banks, and what's obviously being prepared is some kind of major bailout operation for the ailing auto companies. But I think we're going to see more of that as this plays out. We're going to see this incredible contradiction of politicians for years who have made careers out of the notion of self-sufficiency and what have you, who are suddenly going to become heartily in favor of a kind of socialism for the rich and free enterprise for everybody else.
Another statement that's made within this the statement that OCAP put out is, it says, get ready for ordinary people to feel the crunch. You were just talking a little bit before about welfare and some of the work that OCAP has done around welfare. How are ordinary people that you're working with your organization going to feel this economic crisis?
Well, I mean, it's we can only, I think, have some sense of likely directions, because we don't know precisely how this crisis is going to unfold. Is it going to take the form of something clearly massively catastrophic? Is the financial system itself not going to be able to be stabilized, or are they going to get back control of the system and have a sustained downturn throughout 2009 and then some level of recovery? It's the scenarios can play out in various ways, but as this thing starts to accumulate, I think the important thing to recognize is that unlike previous recessions, which weren't as serious as the one that's unfolding, is there was some level of social safety net, as they like to say, available to people, and that's been massively eroded. So people are going to find themselves losing their jobs and losing their homes and immediately being thrown into a situation where unemployment insurance isn't there, where the welfare system is even less adequate than it was in earlier decades. And that's going to have an enormous impact. Already in Ontario, austerity measures are being announced around funding for municipalities. And in this province, welfare is delivered through the municipalities and funded partly by the municipalities. So you could potentially see a situation where not only are welfare offices doing everything they can to deny people assistance, but you could actually have a situation where the financial viability of the welfare system is called into question. You're obviously going to see a massive increase in evictions of tenants and foreclosures for working class homeowners. You're obviously going to see a lot of unemployment, but potentially you could see unemployment taking the form of businesses just collapsing and folding and no money being available for the severance pay and other legal entitlements that people are waiting for. So you could start to see real, very, very serious and profound dislocations starting to happen.
It's interesting because all of these things that you're bringing up, we've had OCAP come on the program for years now talking about these issues. So on the one hand, I guess one could make the argument that this isn't actually a new thing. I mean, is there anything different right now with this economic crisis than basically the social problems that OCAP has been fighting since the beginning of its very existence?
Well, I suppose the answer to that is, I hate to use such a formulation, but it's yes and no, in the sense that yes, I mean, these problems have been emerging and have been intensifying, but they could happen on a scale now that really does change the political landscape and does increase the amount of suffering that's going on in people's lives and the degree to which communities are really up against it. So I think, you know, at a certain point, quantitative changes become qualitative changes. And so already in this office, you know, we deal with lots and lots of people's individual cases. We're seeing a significant increase in the number of people who are coming to us around eviction issues. So already it starts to play out. And you could well see a situation where things start to happen on a scale that makes a response to it, something different than just dealing with the kind of impacts that we've seen up until now in terms of the intensification of poverty.
Let's talk a little bit more about the responses. OCAP goes on to say in the statement that communities under attack will have to organize. What ideas is OCAP putting forward in this time of economic crisis in order for poor people to fight back against some responses that might come from governments and institutions?
Right. Well, it seems to us that people are going to have to begin to organize on essentially two different levels. One is going to be that we're going to have to build up at the local level a capacity to defend people. We're going to start to see the very things I was talking about, evictions, companies folding and abandoning people, welfare offices that are virtually closing their doors on people in need. And there's going to be a need to organize to defend people in that situation. We have a model of direct action casework that we've used over the years, and we would look to contribute to bringing that into communities and organizing people to defend families, to defend individuals. So there'd be that kind of level of organizing. But then I think what is also going to be required is to begin to generalize those things into broader demands and to build a movement around those demands. I mean, it's striking that even such entrenched neoliberal politicians as Harper and Flaherty are beginning to have to reluctantly acknowledge that their notion of never running deficits under any circumstances is not going to be viable. But on the other hand, they're doing everything they can to minimize the degree to which they're prepared to respond to the needs that emerge in this crisis. And we're dealing with a similar scenario with the McGuinty provincial government here. So we're going to have to start actually trying to organize to advance demands around meeting people's needs, around increases in allocations of funds for things like welfare and unemployment insurance and what have you. There's the beginnings of talk around more vigorous pressing for government spending on jobs, public works, and those kinds of things. So, I think there's going to have to be an attempt to ensure that what it really comes down to, as we say in the statement, is that there is a crisis, but that the bill can't just simply be presented to poor people and to working people. The system itself has to be forced to provide for people's needs.
I wanted to shift a little bit to talk about elections, because obviously we've just had two major elections here in North America. We had the Canadian federal elections in October, where I guess the economic crisis hit just close to the beginning of the campaign, and it became the major issue throughout the campaign. And then, of course, with the U.S. elections, some would argue that that economic crisis cost John McCain the election. And then now in Quebec, we're in the middle of an election campaign where what we're seeing is parties from the right to the left basically campaigning around people's fears, I guess you could say, around the economic insecurity. You yourself, you've been organizing with OCAP for many years. Have you seen this phenomenon before of parties and elections having to center themselves around so-called economic crises?
No, I think it was quite remarkable. I mean, the Quebec election is now falling into the same scenario, but there's been a series of elections: the national election here, and then the election in the United States that just happened to arrive at a time when this crisis was actually the few weeks when this crisis was really decisively emerging on the world stage. And so it's perhaps not surprising that the parties and the participants in the election were forced to respond. Of course, what has happened is that there's been people emerging victorious who now consider themselves to have a mandate to deal with the crisis. And what's so striking is that if you look at the statements coming out of the world leaders and the agencies that represent and speak for this system, is the degree to which they don't know what to do, and they're scrambling. In the United States, the new president has been elected on a somewhat nebulous but nonetheless a platform that struck a chord of change. And his administration is going to be dealing with the most incredible increase in the crisis, and people are going to be looking to him to act upon the rhetoric of his election, and I think it's going to lead to quite a politically explosive situation.
There's a lot of our listeners, but voters all across Quebec right now are, I guess, thinking about the upcoming election on December the 8th, and thinking about maybe where they'll cast their ballot, or in terms of which party they're going to vote for. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, what would your message be to low-income voters, either here in Quebec, or it could be anywhere else in Canada, who are thinking about voting based on their fears around the economy. What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I don't presume to tell people what they should do in elections in terms of whether they should vote and how they should view the use of the voting tactic. But at the same time, I do think it's striking and obvious that we're dealing with mainstream political formations that are all dedicated to the stabilizing of this system, and the only way that this capitalist system is going to be stabilized is on the basis is on the backs of most of us. And so whoever emerges in an electoral contest, whether it's in Quebec or whether it's across Canada or whether it's in the United States, is going to be looking to restore stability through the imposition of austerity on the bulk of the population, and that's going to lead to a political contest that isn't going to be settled through elections. It's going to be a question of the mobilization of people in their communities and in their workplaces.
Because the many are in the comments, they keep getting taller. Despite the battles we wage, they keep getting stronger. So we fight the ones we love.
That was an interview brought to us by Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal, an interview with John Clark from Ontario Coalition Against Poverty based in Toronto on the economic crisis, the upcoming elections in Quebec, and the impacts on low-income people. You're listening to CKDU Radio in Halifax, 88.1 on the FM dial, www.ckdu.ca on the internet. This show is called Resistance Radio, brought to you every Tuesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., a show that looks at struggles against capitalism, against colonialism, neocolonialism, neoliberalism, colonization, struggles for decolonization, struggles against war and imperialism and foreign occupation, against torture, against racism, sexism, all forms of oppression, looking at it in a multi-thematic kind of way. So that was a pretty interesting interview. Right now I've got the OCAP website in front of me, and so I think this interview that Aaron Lakoff did was inspired by the recent OCAP communique about the economy goes into crisis. OCAP says, it's their system, they broke it, and we're not paying to fix it. So what they look at is from a lower class or working class perspective, they look at the media's coverage of the crisis, the economic crisis, as well as the reality of the economic crisis for working class and lower class people. The crisis is a product of the investment, the investors who were speculating. So speculative finance, speculation, especially on real estate, and that came crashing down because it was towers of cards built on no real value, but sort of speculative value. So what they estimate the value of land or property would be, when in fact it wasn't that, because for so many reasons. But because it was just speculation. Right, makes sense, eh? Capitalism makes so much sense. So communities struggling against capitalism is a theme now that you could probably find just about anywhere in North America if you're looking at people, a lower class or working class people who are struggling against the economic situation. You could construe that as an anti-capitalist struggle, although you'd probably want to ask the people first before you go labeling anyone. But anyway, the point is, it's more widespread, I'd say, than ever. Anyway, the economy goes into crisis. So OCAP says it's their system, they broke it, and we're not paying for it. They note that the financial bailout, which has been mentioned numerous times in the mainstream media, is a bailout for the rich. And they say, governments everywhere have responded to the crisis of financial institutions by pouring hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars into various bailout packages for the rich. For years, they have been telling us no money exists for decent wages, proper housing, schools, or health care, and certainly no money to ensure that poor people on assistance can pay the rent and eat properly. Now we see that this was all a lie. When the banks and corporations are in trouble, a Niagara Falls of public money suddenly becomes available to them. That's right, $700 billion. Don't tell us when we lose our jobs and can't pay our rent or put food on the table that we can't spend our way out of a recession. Government must start spending for us as they have for corporate interests. So says OCAP, and I think that lays it out pretty clear. They bail out the rich, and could that be because the rich are in control and pulling the strings behind the scenes of government decisions and government choices? That could be one possible reason why the rich get such a huge bailout. And I mean, if you look at Naomi Klein, who's a very well-published, very well-known Toronto-based, originally from Montreal, activist and scholar and academic and writer, she notes that many of the CEOs who were responsible for the bailout all have gotten huge bonuses in the past few years, millions of dollars of bonuses, just 16 people or 10 people, all of who could be directly responsible for the crisis recently in September and October. So that's something that's interesting about this bailout in which they're not telling you. Get ready for ordinary people to feel the crunch, says OCAP. They say, quote, this downturn is unfolding in a context where EI and welfare systems have been cut back considerably over the last few years. Recently, re-elected Harper conservatives have made clear they will not put resources into social programs and other initiatives crucial to our survival. In fact, they will try to do the very opposite. As the downturn cuts into government revenues, government will try to cut programs in order to balance their books. And OCAP says, communities under attack will have to organize. As the downturn hits, we can expect a lot of jobs to be lost. In Ontario, this has already begun in the manufacturing sector. Companies will try to lay off workers without paying money owed to them. The number of people facing eviction for non-payment of rent will go up considerably. And then there's more. And then the last point is, we must fight for what we need. But I wanted to highlight that one sentence there, communities under attack will have to organize, where they say, the number of people facing eviction for non-payment of rent will go up considerably. So eviction, and I want to return to that theme after a musical interlude. And of course, anyway, but to continue on with OCAP, they say, we must fight for what we need. We live under a system of capitalism expressly organized to make profit for a few at the expense of the great majority. As the system moves into crisis, those few will seek solutions that work in their favor. For at least 35 years, capitalists and government have worked to rescind the concessions they made at an early time. Social supports have been removed, workers' rights undermined, and the world markets have been given a free hand to engage in a wild frenzy of parasitic speculation. And so there you have it, the speculation as the root, as the cause of the crisis of October of 2008. And they go on and talk about Dalton McGuinty. The federal government still finds money to wage war in Afghanistan. So anyway, they say, if you'd like to work together and organize, keep in touch. They probably have an email. It's ocap.ca is their website. Lots and lots of information there. But the sentence I wanted to point out and come back to later after some music is the one about eviction. So unscrupulous employers, the number of people facing eviction for non-payment of rent will go up considerably. Not just eviction, but squatting houses. And looking back at the 1929 Depression, the Great Depression, and the outcome of that for working class and poor people to be evicted from their homes, widespread across the USA, and the workers' mobilization and the working and lower class mobilization to take back and reappropriate space, because while they're living on the street homeless, empty homes abound and multiply. So what are the, no one's profiting off these empty homes. They're just sitting there until a better economic time, until real estate and property markets and property value goes back up, and perfectly good houses are being abandoned and empty. And meanwhile, the number of homeless increases. So what did the people do? They decided to take back the homes and take back the property. Direct action, which technically is illegal, but was a widespread phenomenon in the 1930s in the U.S. And so it was predicted that this could happen again. You know, we could see this trend again in North America, although this time in North America, so in Canada as well. And certainly it's what we've seen in Miami, for example. And so after this short musical interlude, we're going to be talking about a group in Miami called Take Back the Land, who facilitate housing takeovers. It was an article released November 26th last week. So again, this is Resistance Radio bringing to you stories of struggles against capitalism. And what better story is there when we're talking about the economic crisis, but taking back housing and squatting. Squatting land, squatting homes, squatting a place to live. Aquí estamos escuchando Radio Resistencia. Nos volvemos después de esta canción. On écoute le Radio Resistance. On va retourner après cette chanson. Merci pour nous écouter. On est chaque mardi à 5h30 à CKDU 88.1 FM.
Canada is the world's leading mining nation. 60% of all public mining companies are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. About half of all mining capital is raised in Canada. Many Canadian mining companies have become notorious for damaging communities and the environment and fueling wars and repression worldwide. CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax is proud to present Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World, a three-part documentary. Tune in to hear testimonies from affected communities in Papua New Guinea, the Congo, Guatemala, and Canada itself, and to consider the question, who benefits from Canadian mining operation? Tune in on Fridays, December 5th, 12th, and 19th between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. on Operation Wake Up. It's brought to you by CKBU 88.1 FM in Halifax.
Whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your SolarWinds son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could a Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. My dad came into my room holding his hat. I knew he was leaving. He sat on my bed, told me some facts, son. I have a duty calling on me. You and your sister, be brave, my little soldier. And don't forget all I told you. You're the mister of the house, now remember this. And when you wake up in the morning, give your mama a kiss. Then I had to say goodbye. In the morning, woke mama with a kiss on each eyelid. Even though I'm only a kid, certain things can't be hid. Mama grabbed me, held me like I was made of gold, but left her in the stories untold. I said, Mama, it'll be alright when Daddy comes home tonight. Whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your SolarWinds son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could a Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage, overcome. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. My story stops here. Let's be clear, this scenario is happening everywhere. And you ain't going to Nirvana or Farvana. You coming right back here to live out your karma with even more drama than previously. Seriously. Just how many centuries have we been waiting for someone else to make us free? And we refuse to see that people overseas suffer just like we. Bad leadership and egos unfettered and free. To feed on the people they're supposed to lead. I don't need the people to pray and wait for the Lord to make it all straight. There's only now, do it right. Cause I don't want your daddy leaving home tonight. Whether long-range weapon or suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether your SolarWinds son or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could a Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether Halliburton, Enron or anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. We need to find courage, overcome. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction. Inaction is a weapon of mass destruction.
Good evening. I would like to report on the state of our war against the American people. We're mounting a sustained campaign to crack down on every American and every person of every faith and every nation, and to bring them to justice. All missions are being executed according to plan, without warning or provocation. Americans are being swept up in an international dragnet. Thousands of FBI agents are on the trail of other citizens here and abroad. It has everything to do with hate and evil and murder and prejudice. America's strong, strong, strong.
Federal agents, we are armed! Welcome to the new.
You got it,
So you're listening to CKDU 88.1 FM, www.ckdu.ca on the internet. Perhaps you're listening to us on the internet. Perhaps we're streaming live right now as we speak. We were talking about the economic crisis earlier before the musical interlude. Oh, by the way, we heard Mass Destruction by Faithless, and we also heard Le Tigre with the song New Kicks, both from the album Peace Not War, a compilation. Le Tigre featured some spoken word from Amy Goodman, who is the starring journalist of Democracy Now!, which we broadcast here on CKDU Monday to Friday, noon to 1 p.m. And we kind of left off. We heard an interview with John Clark from OCAP in Toronto about the economic crisis, about the elections, and about the repercussions for lower class and working class peoples. And we wanted to look at capitalism as sort of the root cause behind the economic crisis and the inevitability of crises in a free market, deregulated neoliberal model, capitalist model of globalized economy. And we were looking at a historical precedent as well, the Great Depression of 1929 and then throughout the decade of the 1930s, the Great Depression in the U.S. and I guess in Canada as well. But in the U.S., one of the reasons back then, just like it is for 2008, one of the reasons for the economic crisis back then was speculation on property value and the real estate economy crashing. So this massive speculation and widespread increased value speculated on property and land, not based on real value, but based on imagined future values, suddenly come crashing down. Fear of investors and gambling on basically on values which they expected and planned and betted on rising, which actually didn't rise, but etc. So anyway, property value figures prominently in this. And so anyway, what happened in the 30s was people were evicted widespread on a massive scale across the U.S. And for many working class and lower class people who were evicted, who became homeless, they took the action into their own hands and squatted houses and went back to houses that had evictions. So no one was living in them, and houses that were foreclosed. I guess that's the word. So foreclosed houses. And no one was living in them. And so one analysis that kind of underlies this phenomena of homeless people squatting foreclosed homes is that they have a right to housing. And I don't know if that's one of the United Nations stipulated human rights, is a right to a home or not. But they also say there's a right to a profit, which Marxists, you know, would disagree to or whatever. So it's interesting. Anyway, we're not going to discuss the UN Declaration of Human Rights, but the point is people took direct action into their own hands and said and alleviated the injustice in their lives by taking houses, squatting them, basically illegally going back into empty homes and living in them, because that was the way to alleviate their homeless situation. And why that makes sense, I mean, it makes sense why that would be an obvious solution for someone living on the streets, but why it wasn't an obvious solution for the powers that be, for the powers of social control, I mean, the government and larger financed institutions, why they were NGOs or what have you, why they wouldn't have done that. Well, I mean, according to OCAP, so we were speaking about OCAP's communique before, their reasoning why that wouldn't happen is because the financial bailout and sort of the financial system benefits the rich. And when there's a bailout or when there's a crisis, the bailout or the solution is something that would benefit the rich, but not the poor, because they're more interested in the rich, such being a class analysis. Anyway, so that's one possible analysis to take on it. So I'm just going to read you, unfortunately, this video link isn't working. So I'm just going to read you a few pieces about, current day actions. So what's really interesting about the depression from 1929 and the 30s and these homeless people who had been evicted, squatting and taking back and reappropriating empty housing blocks and empty apartments and foreclosed homes, is that now in 2008, again with another crisis, this time the worst global crisis in global history, again the same phenomena is happening. So people are taking back homes, taking back housing, squatting homes. And so in Miami, there's a group called Take Back the Land who has been facilitating housing takeovers. And this comes from a listserv called Money Banks Crisis. This comes from Anarchid. As the government continues to bail out the mega corporations responsible for this economic crisis, by taking our housing tax money without our permission and giving it to the wealthy, some organizations and individuals are moving their own bailout. Since October 2007, Take Back the Land, an autonomous collective in Miami, has been identifying vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes and liberating them by moving homeless people into people-less homes without permission from the government or the banks. And he says, this is the real bailout. He goes on to say, so as this country celebrates the pilgrims, he's referring to Thanksgiving, I guess, who took over land without permission from the owner, so he's referring to colonization, we must think about using land to benefit people, not just corporations. We assert that our right to housing supersedes the corporate right to profit. Below are three stories about the Take Back the Housing campaign by Take Back the Land, and we're going to go to one of them right now. This is called Squatters by Natalie O'Neill from MiamiNewTimes.com, the November 20th edition. Don't cry, just move into one of those empty homes around the corner, says Natalie O'Neill. And then she writes, her knee-length dreadlocks wrapped in a green cloth, Cassie hoists her two-year-old daughter up on a hip and shuffles in her socks into her big, clean bedroom. This house is a castle, says the slender, soft-skinned former university teaching assistant, shaking her head in disbelief. I've never had a walk-in closet, and all this space. 2 months ago, Cassie, which is not her real name, was homeless, out in the rain, with her four kids. Now she has a three-bedroom, two-bathroom, sky-blue house on a tree-lined street in Miami's Buena Vista neighborhood. She takes warm showers, cooks vegan dinners, and watches the news on a small, fuzzy TV screen. The only catch? The house isn't hers. Cassie is a squatter and, at any moment, could be arrested for trespassing, even burglary. So it... This article is about her story, and then so Take Back the Land got involved. Take Back the Land is this collective which has 10 volunteers, and it first gained national media attention 2 years ago in 2006 after setting up a contentious shanty town called Umoja Village in Liberty City, asserting the black community's right to own land in its own neighborhood. As they were quoted as saying, they erected 21 shanties on public land using wooden pallets and tarps. And that reminds me so much of the, what are they called in Spanish? Plazados, I think, when different communities will march to a capital city to demand their rights to their land, or when there's an injustice happening. This has happened in Guatemala, in Colombia, in many different capital cities in Latin America, where indigenous communities or peasant communities will march to the capital and then set up a shanty town basically in the plaza square of the capital town in front of the city hall or in front of the government, the federal buildings, demanding that some resolution happen or some resolution to the conflict in the hinterlands or in the rural areas. Sounds totally like that, a shanty town. Because that's what they do. They build these like temporary shanty towns in government, in public squares. Another article about squatting and this group Take Back the Land working in Miami comes to us from Mother Jones, which is www.motherjones.com. Smart, fearless journalism. They're pretty good as a news source if you're ever interested in checking them out, based in the U.S. The article is called Foreclosure Nation, Squatters or Pioneers, and it's by Tristram Corton. It appeared in the May-June issue of 2008. And it says, Mamira Prosper steps gingerly over ankle-high grass strewn with plastic bags and empty soda bottles in the yard of a vacant red brick house in Miami's Liberty City. She peers through a gap in a boarded-up window. It looks in good shape, she says. I mean, the walls aren't falling down. This is definitely one of our stronger options. Prosper means that if the place checks out, she and her colleagues from Take Back the Land, a local group that advocates for affordable housing, will break in, change the locks, paint and clean, innovate a way to connect water and electricity, and then move a homeless family into the house. The criminal laws they'll violate in the process range from trespassing to breaking and entering, even burglary if the police get ambitious, which requires the organization to keep a pro bono lawyer on standby. We call it liberating the housing, says Take Back the Land's co-founder Max Rameau, a compact Haitian American who's earned a reputation in Miami for creative activism. So, what an exciting, liberating story. So, hey, Miami is the place to go if you're into housing liberation of housing for homeless peoples. And, I mean, this is just another example of direct action to solve the needs of immediate poverty and killer poverty that that starves people, that makes people go cold and go hungry. An immediate solution to that, which again is illegal, but it's a direct action and it seems to be solving the problems for these homeless people who in a lot of cases have been evicted recently. And again, that's what happened in 1930s. So a trend. And then the question that I think the show is asking on an overall level of the today's show, when we're looking at the economic crisis, is these sort of crises that seem to be habitual, are they an inevitable outcome of the capitalist economy, of neoliberalism, of free market capitalism, of deregulation, of all these policies which leave people out in the cold and leave them starving? Is it an inevitability that economies will come crashing down? So that's something that we want to ask. And if you have the answer to that question and you just want to chat, give us a call because you've got 7 more minutes to the end of the show at 494-2487. That's what you're listening to. I mean, what are you listening to? It's Resistance Radio on CKDU 88.1 FM, www.ckdu.ca on the internet. Resistance Radio is also a show brought to you in Spanish and French occasionally. Haven't done it in a while. Would love to do a show in Spanish or French soon. And in lieu of that, we're going to play a track right now. It's in Spanish. Again, give us a call, 494-2487. I'll be around till 6:30. After that, we've got some exciting more shows coming up to you. Share the Air with Aaron Ashley, Car Bomb to the Heart with Don Adams, Sonic Society with Jack and Shannon, and Love Dies Last, The Goth Show with Jen Stotland. We'll be right back.
En el Pacífico hay de todo para que goce. Cantaores, colores, buenos sabores y muchos santos para que adore. Ok, es toda una conexión como un corrillo. Chocó, Valle, Cauca y mis paisanos de Nariño. Todo ese repertorio me produce orgullo. Y si somos tantos porque estamos tan al cucho. Bueno, dejemos ese punto a un lado. Hay gente trabajando pero son contados. Allá rastrillan, hablan jergueado. Te preguntas si no has jangueado, si estás quedado. Si lo has copiado, lo has vacilado. Si dejaste el que está malo o te lo has rumbiado. Hay mucha calentura en Buenaventura. Y si sos chocuano, sos arrecho por cultura. ¡Ey!
Hasta por la tierra, no hay quien se me pierda, con un vínculo familiar que aterra, característico en muchos de nosotros que nos reconozca.